Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. This episode continues the conversation about the future of Charlotte that we started in the previous episode of Southbound. It's a live recording of the event we held on March 28th at WFAE's Civic and Community Engagement Center in Uptown Charlotte. This time around, we talked about affordable housing, equity, and how to learn from Charlotte's history. Our three panelists are experts in their fields. Charisse Blackman is Executive Director of the Westside Community Land Trust, a nonprofit that buys and renovates homes in gentrifying areas of West Charlotte with the goal of preserving affordable housing. Allison Craig is the City of Charlotte's Director of Planning, Design, and Development. As part of her job, she led the crafting of what's known as the City's 2040 Plan, which sets standards for the city's future growth and development. And Monique Douglas is Executive Director of the Brooklyn Collective, a nonprofit for artists and small businesses. It's named for Charlotte's old Brooklyn neighborhood, which was almost completely erased in the 60s. As part of what was then called urban renewal. We covered lots of ground. Here's our conversation. So let's get right into it, y'all. Here's my first question. We'll start with Charisse and kind of work our way inward. What is the most pressing issue in your area of expertise, the thing that maybe keeps you up at night?
One of the most pressing issues and or challenges is the immense pressure that I feel to keep up with a rapidly fast-moving, fast-paced real estate market, dissipating affordable housing stock, and just the overall competitive disadvantage that we're at as a nonprofit when trying to compete in this market, and having to balance that against the very real reality that people are losing their homes and there's housing instability and the funds are moving slowly and things of that nature. That's, you know, a major challenge for us. I cannot enumerate the number of community meetings that I have attended where neighbors are talking about the poor conditions that they're living in and just really reflecting and speaking to the need for better quality affordable housing. And all of this is happening while we're trying to balance what's happening in the market versus some of the very real barriers that we face. And so that is a major challenge for us.
Allison?
I think for me, the thing that keeps me up at night and the thing that I'm grappling with every single day is just trying to manage growth coming to Charlotte. And so it's great to be a city that's growing. You don't want to be a city that's dying, but with a city that's growing comes lots and lots of change. There's lots of challenges. There's lots of competing priorities. And so it's trying to find a way that, you know, you're bringing affordable housing, you're protecting the tree canopy, trying to manage the infrastructure challenges. And so, and everyone wants to talk about all the people that are coming to Charlotte, but there's also all these people that live in Charlotte right now. And so how are you managing the new people that are coming while making sure that you're maintaining the character of the community? And so it's just, I think growth is really what keeps me up at night, trying to find the right solution, the right tools, knowing that in the state of North Carolina, we do not have a lot of tools, like we're called a Dillon Rule state, in which we are only allowed to put into ordinance and to regulate things that the state expressly tells us that we can. Mm-hmm. And so that means I can't require affordable housing, I can't charge impact fees. There's a lot of tools that I don't have. I just have a bunch of carrots and not a lot of sticks. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just really trying to be very thoughtful and proactive about how Charlotte wants to grow and what she wants to be when she grows up.
And I think in my world, which is of course the creative space, but it's a fusion of history too. And so the challenge is, as we're growing as a city, how do we, number one, make sure that we maintain respect for the history of our city? And that's the history in all aspects of it, right? in, of course, in our particular segment, it would be the Black history of Charlotte, because it's constantly being destroyed and removed, and the little pieces that we do have left, how do we, in all this growth and all these new things and new developments and new infrastructures for business that are happening, how do we still hold on to the few treasures that are still left here in the city? And how do we get the respect enough that it's just as important while we're working on the corridors of opportunity, that it's just as important to pour funding into preserving these old buildings?
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have a 102-year-old building and a 122-year-old building that still has a slate roof, there's challenges that come with maintaining historical buildings. It's expensive, right? The upkeep, and we want them to be here for the city to enjoy.
Is there something about Charlotte, about the culture of Charlotte, that makes your job harder or easier? Allison, do you want to start with that?
I think one of the things that I think I like about Charlotte is that we're a really unique fabric of a bunch of different neighborhoods that all have their own character. And I think that that's something that's really cool and I enjoy about Charlotte. You go to different parts of the city and they're just completely different. I think one challenge that we have is just when we look at, like, so I'm preparing a presentation this morning and I was looking at tree canopy data, and you look at the amount of tree canopy throughout the city of Charlotte, and it is so segregated in terms of the arc and the wedge. It's just, it's sad. And so, and you look at so many other variables, whether it's access to housing, access to goods, all these different parameters, and it is just clear that just decades of bad planning practices and just redlining and racial segregation are still perpetuated today. And so I think that's one of the things I think is really hard, and one of the things we're really trying to work on as a city is how you fix some of those things. So while I love all the different neighborhoods in the city of Charlotte, there's still like a huge problem to overcome for our city.
Nick, you want to go next?
One of the things I love about Charlotte is we really do have such a melting pot of individuals. And I think coming in, right, we're having just this influx because the banking industry, people are coming from all different areas. And so it's making Charlotte just an amazing place for that diversity that's coming in. What I'm excited about, too, is to see some of the changes that are happening in the artistic realm, in the creatives realm, where, you know, before creatives were just kind of separated. It was, okay, these are your musicians, these are your visual artists, these are, you know, and these are your performing artists, and they're all over here in their little segments. And what I love to see now is that we really are working hard as a city to kind of bring all those communities together to say, this is the creative community in our city, in our Queen City. And that makes it exciting for us at the Brooklyn Collective, because any of you who've been there know that we honor history and we celebrate artistry. So we have a building that celebrates visual artistry, a building that celebrates local musical talent, and then a building that celebrates performing arts. Seeing the city really trying hard to put together that kind of arts collaborative effort, I think is a really good thing.
Sharice?
I think that we're blessed to live in a city that is open to acknowledging harm and really rallying around creating a solution for it. So we know that when the Chetty study was introduced, we had an entire task force that was started behind that. Or when we noticed that we were in an affordable housing crisis, then there was a $100 million housing trust fund that we advocated for and voted for and then deployed. We know that when we started to look at low opportunity communities in the Crescent, then we saw that the mayor started to have a corridors of opportunity initiative where investment was incentivized in those specific areas. And so we have a reputation of recognizing that there is and was harm inflicted and then working together to try to find a solution. I think the caveat to that, which is a challenge and an opportunity for growth for us here in Charlotte, is that, you know, sometimes I think we have to understand the reality of the fact that poverty is manufactured. It didn't just happen, right? Low opportunity communities didn't just happen. This was created. And so how could we have been more intentional in practice to be proactive as we were developing or as we've been making investments to ensure that we weren't creating those challenges? Do we need a study to tell us that, you know, families that live in the West Corridor and are in food deserts are hungry? No, they know they're hungry, and they've been telling us that for a long time. So I think a challenge with that is that sometimes, and you know, one of the things I get frustrated with is that sometimes we appear to not be aware of what has been manufactured, when really is it that we're unaware, or have we ignored it until it became blatantly apparent and we could no longer ignore it? And so there's a lot of rhetoric that exists, a lot of reactionary rhetoric, but how can we really have a proactive, action-oriented response and some intentionality surrounding what it is we do in our city?
Yeah, thank you. Just to fill in the one blank for folks who may be new to Charlotte, Charisse referenced the Chetty study, which was a study by, a Harvard researcher from several years ago that said of the 50 biggest metro areas in America, Charlotte was last in economic mobility, which means that it's harder to get from the bottom up the ladder here than it is anywhere else. And that's been a big focus of a lot of the work that various government and non-government agencies have been doing since then. I wonder about the places where y'all's, the three of you, your concerns, goals sort of overlap and where maybe they diverge. I know Allison and Charisse, obviously, you two deal a lot with housing. Charisse, Monique, I think you two deal a lot with, in a larger sense, preservation in a lot of ways. I'm wondering if y'all think a lot about where your goals and all might overlap and where they might be, if anywhere, in any conflict. Nate, you want to start there?
Definitely no conflict. but I do believe, yes, overlap certainly in what our mission is at the Brooklyn Collective, because in order to begin to affect change in the areas that both of them work within, we have to understand the areas where things went wrong, which means we gotta go back and dig into history, which is not always the most pleasant thing to do, right? So when we talk about Brooklyn in Charlotte, we're not talking about some little tiny neighborhood. We're talking about over 1,400 homes, over 200 businesses, and 13 large churches. And to date, out of that entire expanse, which most of you would consider Second Ward, there's 4 buildings left. That's a question mark. How did that happen? Why did that happen? And then what are we going to learn from that entire piece of history here in the Queen City, which most people don't even know about, right? I mean, I can tell you, we have hundreds of people every month that come through our facility, and we actually have the history on the walls, so you can read it. Thanks to Levine Museum of the New South, when they closed the location up the street, they sponsored. We have a history walk with some of the Brooklyn pieces that they had in the museum. And so you actually can walk through and visually see this, what happened. But what happened was that in the early 1960s to early 1970s, they destroyed, in that 10-year period, this entire neighborhood. What happened was unjust. It was the way it was done. Promises were made for affordable housing. Oh, we're going to fix this up, move y'all over here, and then we're going to move you back into your neighborhood. And that never happened. And so what they did was they labeled or tabbed the neighborhood as a blighted neighborhood. And then with them having that designation, they were able to get it under the federal government's program called Urban Renewal, right? And then there began the ticket to destroy these 238 acres of land, right, that made up this neighborhood. In the destruction of the neighborhood of Brooklyn, over 7,000 residents were displaced. Mm. That's sobering. 7,000, that's not a small amount of people, right? And a lot because they didn't own their land. And so now you have these families scurrying, trying to figure out where are they going to live, right? Many because they lived in the shotgun homes that were owned by slumlords who they got paid for the land, which displaced the residents, right? So now what did they do? Many fled into what we now refer to as these corridors of opportunity. In fact, the Beatty's Ford Corridor, they began to call that the new Brooklyn when the old Brooklyn or the original Brooklyn was destroyed. And so you still have folks within those neighborhoods. We're not talking that long ago.
Right.
We're talking about 1970s. And so these families are still generations trying to recoup from what they thought was going to be legacy that's now been pulled out from under them. And so it falls right in line with both of their work. There's no conflict there.
Right.
It's really just trying to continue to pick up pieces for families that have had years of oppression because of unjust behavior in the part of the city. And that's just real talk.
Trace?
Yeah, just to piggyback off of that, like, it's interesting that while Monique is speaking about the history of urban renewal, how the work that the land trust is involved in is really combating modern day urban renewal. So the same narrative as far as the displacement that has been happening, the slum lords, individuals that are investing in properties and own them and have people living and renting there, trying to make as little investment as possible so that they can increase their profit margin. The dissipating culture that we see constantly being erased in our communities, where homes that were in these neighborhoods for generations are now being demolished and replaced with new and shiny, you know, beautiful so-called things, instead of seeing the beauty that was in the history and the culture and the character of the neighborhood and the community that has helped to build and served as the foundation of this great city. And so I think there's definitely a lot of overlap when we talk about equity, when we talk about preservation and even progress. We want to progress. When I speak with neighbors that are in these communities, previously it was Brooklyn, but now Brooklyn can also be known as Cherry or as Greer Heights or as Lakeview or as Noda or as Howie Acres. We see this happening all across Charlotte. And when I talk with individuals in these communities, they want progress. They have a vision for themselves. They have a vision for their neighborhood. And they want to implement that, but they just want to also be able to stay in the community that they've called home for so long. And so I definitely think there's a lot of overlap with our work. I think we just actualize it in different ways.
Sure. So, and I'll say that, so in 2021, the city of Charlotte adopted our first comprehensive plan, vision for growth in 45 years. And equity and looking at the wrongs of the past was like a central tenet of the comprehensive plan. And it was woven through like all of the policies and programs that are embedded in that document. It really is acknowledging the past and apologizing and certainly recognizing that planning and zoning played a role in that as well. And then starting to really put forth proactive, sincere efforts to correct those things. And so, and there's a lot of ways that we are working through some of those, and some of it is making sure that residents are given tools to help maintain the character of their neighborhood, making sure that people have a say in what happens in their communities, and they know how to access information and how to be a part of the process going forward. And it's about making sure that we have housing opportunities for everyone. Like, housing affordability is something that I talk about and think about every single day of my life, and really trying to find a way in which Charlotte is becoming a place where everyone can live and live in a way that's comfortable for them. And so I think there's a lot that the city is trying to do things better and to do things right for Charlotte's future.
The things that you do, parts of them are kind of naturally controversial in some ways. Like, Charisse, I'm sure there are a lot of people who don't want some collective model of homeownership in Charlotte neighborhoods. Allison, you work for the city, so people always complain about the city in one way or another. And Monique, I'm sure that some of the history you talk about is history that people would just as soon not revisit. I wonder how y'all deal with people who are critical of not just a particular decision that you might make, but sort of the premise of what you do. Charisse, you want to start on that?
Yeah, I think there was some great mind that said, I can show you better than I can tell you. And for us, that's very true. So, you know, when we hear pushback or opposition, where people question things like, how can a shared equity model build wealth? How can it build real wealth? Or the land trust model is limited in scope. It can only serve for, you know, residential real estate purposes and things of that nature. When we hear those things, then I try to meet that with proof. And I can tell you all day that this is an evidence-based, empirically proven model. It's been implemented over 300 times across the nation. It has demonstrated to have the most stability in housing, even in the economic recession. I think the foreclosure rate for community land trust homes was 1%. So I can tell you all these things and you can still choose not to believe me. But the one thing that you cannot fight against is proof. And someone else said that the proof is in the pudding. So what do? We make pudding. We have somebody like Mr. Frank, who is over 65 years old, who never owned a home, who has lived in the Enderley Park community for generations, for decades. He's lived in that community and never thought that he could own a home. And even if he decided that he wanted one, a product did not exist for him to own one, to give him even the opportunity to be able to build wealth through home ownership. So I can show you him and his house and how now his mortgage is fixed, right? And he's paying a very low mortgage. We were able to transition a Section 8 voucher to home ownership. And so now he's able to build wealth. He's able to transfer this house to his heir, to his son, when he passes away. And even if he chose to transfer it to him early as an heir, he could buy on the open market through this model. We gave him an opportunity to own a home where there was not otherwise an opportunity. So there's an example of that. Or even when we talk about wealth building, equity is invisible wealth in some ways. And so we can even show through the pudding as proof that we have an ADU model where not only are we selling our homes to low-income home buyers, but right behind that home are tiny homes, accessory dwelling units, actually the shotgun houses that were facing demolition that were owned by the Harvey Gantt Center. Those homes exist and those can be rented out to individuals affordably, and we split the rent and share that as very real, tangible income that goes into the pockets of these homeowners. And then when we, you know, when people say the model is limited, you can only do apartments or you can only do home ownership units, then we join alongside neighbors and we champion the development of a mixed use space in a school that neighbors wanted to reclaim. And lastly, I'll say, like, even with affordability, there are homes out here being sold for $260,000 for a town house, and that is through affordable housing agencies. And that's affordable to someone, but through our organization, again, through the proof, we can demonstrate how we can create a house that has high-end finishes, hardy plank siding, hardwood floor, ceramic tile, and we can sell that house for $180,000, $185,000 at the price point that a family of four earning 60% of AMI can afford. And so again, we can demonstrate, we could talk all day, or we can demonstrate through action what's truly possible as a way to respond to opposition.
As you might have noticed, don't get Charisse started on the numbers. She's got the numbers in hand. Allison, you may have heard that some people are not thrilled with every aspect of the 2040 plan and other things involved. How do you handle that?
Great question. So I feel like working for the city, the best case scenario I could probably have is that everyone is a little bit mad at me. And so I don't think that there's probably any scenario in which everyone is happy, but I feel like if everyone's maybe a little dissatisfied, then maybe I've been successful. It's been a rough couple of years for sure. Just going through the growing pains of implementing the vision and trying to go back and make sure that you're achieving that. But the important thing is that we spent months and years and workshops and meetings and pop-ups, like listening and listening and listening to people, hearing what it is that they want, what they were frustrated with, what they wanted to change, what they wanted to preserve or protect. While not everyone, you know, will love everything that's in that plan, somebody in this community sat there with their heart open and told staff, like, this is something that's really important to me. That's what we have to understand, is that, you know, while we're all here trying to make Charlotte a better place, what better means is different to different people. And so leaving room for different perspectives to be on the table so that we all can have something that we're proud of here in Charlotte.
Monique?
So I'm gonna make you laugh. We're at the Brooklyn Collective, and we literally sit on South Brevard Street, which is in the 2040 plan to be pedestrian. So we knew nothing about the 2040 plan. And the way we found out about it was we saw an article, and in the article there was a little picture, and it was a picture of our building with some flags going across to a potential building across the street. And we were like, is that our building? What are they getting ready to do? That's a part of the things that we would like to see improve a little more. No one's ever knocked on our historic building doors to say, hey, we're getting ready to do this. It's going into a plan. And being that you all are the original Brooklyn, not the brand new Brooklyn project getting ready to come, you're the real deal. We want to talk to you because y'all are smack in the middle of the plan for this street. No one ever did that. So for us, we were in plumb shock. We were like, what? 2040, what? We're sitting in the middle of the whole thing, right? In between the Hornets Arena and the NASCAR Hall of Fame, right in the middle.
Well, guess what? There's somebody
now,
you can talk to.
I know. That's why I'm so excited. I'm like, this is great. This is great. Because, again, it's just a part of some of the things that we see from our position because of the historic nature of where we are, that people pass by all the time, but it's almost like we're not seen. We're working very diligently to try to get the city to understand why this project needs to be funded because of the historic value and the work that we're trying to do. People don't even know from an upward mobility standpoint that we actually have on the second and third floors of the Mecklenburg Investment Company building, the original four founders of that building intended for it to be an incubator, and that's what it was, an incubator for small businesses. It was Black businesses at the time. What they felt their mission was to provide them with the resources and support that they needed to grow and scale. So they had doctors, attorneys, and dentists, you know, different businesses on the second and third floors. And so the Brooklyn Collective read about what they started out as and said, my goodness, you know, they had a wheel that was working. This was Black wealth. South Brevard Street was the Black Wall Street of Charlotte. Maybe we just need to go back to the wheel that was working. Mm-hmm. And so we incubate 9 small businesses and nonprofits and an artist in residence program on the second and third floors of that building, just as they did back in the early 1900s. These programs need help and funding and the entire project, you know, and so we would like to see the city embrace us as a project that is really working hard to keep the heritage of our city going, but also to contribute to the upward mobility and a space for our creatives, because we hear this all the time. Man, there's nowhere for us to be able to play anymore, or we need spaces where we can create art, right? And so the Brooklyn Collective offers all of that, but again, it takes the support of our city and organizations that are in our city that can help us in funding these initiatives, especially even with our youth that we have coming into the building. So there's still work to be done, but we definitely don't like to focus on the negative. If you come to us at the Brooklyn Collective, we will tell you, this is what happened. It is not a positive thing, but what we want to do is focus on solutions.
When we come back, our panelists discuss how they take care of themselves in stressful times and how regular citizens can make a difference. That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to our recording of Southbound Live. If there was a switch you could flip, and you could say, this particular rule goes into effect tomorrow, a piece of legislation or a city ordinance or whatever it is, or you could flip another switch and get rid of one. Is there something in particular that you think of that would make your life easier and better? Allison, you want to start there?
I figured you'd start with me. I think I would have the ability to charge impact fees.
Could you explain what that is?
Sure. Real quick? I've worked in other states that had this allowance. So when a development project comes in, the developer has to pay fees. There's different models, but they go to like schools and roads and water and sewer, and they go to all the infrastructure that supports development. And it really is a tax that the development community pays to be able to develop what they want. And we can't do that in the state of North Carolina. And it's a little controversial to say, I'm sure if there are any real estate people here, they would not like that. But at the same time, what it does is it unlocks the ability to help manage growth because the city can't pay for that by ourselves. And so I think we all recognize that in our communities, like we need sidewalks, we need additional lanes, we need more bus routes, we need more ability to get around the city, more tree canopies. We don't have an unlimited amount of money to be able to pay for those. And if we could charge an impact fee, it's an easy check. It could make things ultimately faster for the development community to get through. And then we've got a funding source to help build the building blocks that I think we all need in our neighborhoods. Because I can tell you for sure, like, there's no way that we could pay to build all the sidewalks that we need in the city of Charlotte so badly.
Yeah. Monique?
Such a good question. And I hate to always have to go back on this, but this is so important. I would like to see more support in funding. The bottom line is you can't do great things if you have no money.
Amen.
And my look, the actual owner, Jason, of the Jason Wolf of the Brooklyn Collective buildings themselves, and my husband and I, we are so tapped out. Because you know how they say you can only carry it on your own back, but for a certain time frame. After that, you have to have an infusion of funds. And that infusion is what is going to allow you to really dig deep so that you can build it in a sustainable way. It cannot be sustained just off of three people's back, right? Right now in the city, there's so much focus on the corridors of opportunity, which is extremely important. But even though we are not in the corridors of opportunity, you know, they look at us as though, well, y'all are uptown, y'all are fine. But no, it's historic. It's historic buildings that need help. We've already built the model. and shown that the programming works and shown the impact that it's had on our musicians, on our visual artists, on our performing artists. Even the Blumenthal utilized us during the pandemic when all the theaters were closed. We've shown the impact. And now it's, hey, we need help because we want to keep it alive and open for the community, and we want them to walk in the history.
Charisse?
So there are many things. I'm over here like, oh, which one am I going to talk about? But I guess I'll say, and Allison mentioned it earlier, I think inclusionary zoning will be very helpful. And maybe she can help me understand, because it is supposedly illegal in North Carolina, but Chapel Hill implements it. And essentially with inclusionary zoning, there is a required set aside for any type of development that happens for some units that are affordable. And so it's not an option. If you're developing, you have to set aside this number of units. And then Chapel Hill, those units go through their land trust for permanent affordability. And so that would be extremely helpful just to make sure that it's baked into our infrastructure, that as we're developing, as we're progressing, as these neighborhoods are shifting and changing, we're still being intentional about and are required to ensure that there's place and space for people of lower incomes.
And if I could just jump in and say that Chapel Hill had some special legislation. They've also been legally challenged a number of times on that, because we've talked about it a lot. And actually, it's in the comprehensive plan to explore changing that at the state level. But very clear guidance from our attorneys that this is not something, again, going back to the Dillon rule, the state has not said that we are able to require affordable housing. So therefore, we only have carrots in our toolbox. We don't have any of those requirements that we can put in to make sure that we are getting affordable housing.
So when you had mentioned the feeling of having the whole thing on your back, and I wanted to ask all of you, because all of you have pretty high stress jobs and there's a lot at stake in what all of you do, how do you sort of manage your time and emotional well-being? And maybe you want to start there.
You know, it's always a challenge, right? The balancing of it all, because to your point, you said what keeps you up at night when you're leading these different types of initiatives. I mean, this becomes for us a heart thing. Like, this is serious to us, which is why we've taken on the positions of leadership. Because we're like, we want to see change, and we want to be a part of it. But at the same time, because it is a heart thing, it does keep you up at night. So, you know, I've been learning how to de-stress. Sometimes you just got to detach. Sometimes I just escape. Like, you know, I escape. That's one of the ways I do it. But I'm also a poet, and I write. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they tell you sometimes one of the best ways to kind of relieve stress or whatever the things are that are bogging and weighing you down is to put it on paper, right? So some people might journal. You know, I write poetry. But that's a way that I'm able to get it out. But also, you know, I believe in family, being with my family, my husband, my children, my grands. That brings me a lot of joy, and it's another way I de-stress. We do feel like we carry the weight of the world on our shoulders at times. You're right.
Yeah. Charisse?
Yeah, I think the answer for me is to be determined. But what I've been trying to do is really, again, like, institutionalized self-care. I feel that it's important for me to, as a leader, to practice what I'm preaching, and how can we want neighbors to want to demonstrate care for themselves and demonstrate care for their family members and their finances and all of these things that are a part of self-actualization if I am not also demonstrating care for myself. So one of the things that I realized was most of the time I am not going to take time off. But if I make it a part of our policy, policies where not only am I encouraging staff to do that, but also like, you don't have a choice, you're closed this week, then I am forced to engage in self-care practices. And so that's one of the things that I've started to do with the Land Trust. We have two organizational breaks throughout the year. Each one is a week long where the entire agency is shut down so that we can rejuvenate ourselves. And so just making it a part of our practice so we can demonstrate to ourselves and to others what self-care is and should be.
Allison?
What I do, I there's many, many nights where I'm waking up in the middle of the night, like worrying or thinking about something, or I forgot something or whatever. So there's lots of nights like that of worry, but I do almost every morning do some form of exercise. I actually gave a graduation speech to a bunch of supervisors this morning, and I kind of talked to them about the importance of taking care of yourself, because if you can't take care of yourself, you can't take care of all the other things that you're trying to take care of. And so for me, it's about exercise. And so the only decision I have to make when I do this is I show up and then I go to a class, and for an hour or 45 minutes, someone else tells me what to do. And I say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. And that is for me a major way to kind of just take a break for a second. But I've also really been focusing very heavily in the last year or so on family. I've lost two family members over the last few years that were very close to me. And my staff is so, and I've had some issues, you know, some staff that have had those same challenges. And so the pandemic, gratefully, has offered us an opportunity to be a little bit more flexible in our day. And I think it's allowed the city, which normally would not be like this, a place where you would think you'd have a very flexible schedule, but they've been pretty good about that, because my daughter's 13 now, and so she doesn't really want to talk to me when she gets home from school. But, you know, like for the, you know, moms or dads that have younger kids, when they get off the bus, like just like those 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, that you can just connect. Hey, how's your day? Okay, well, go do your homework, that kind of thing. And being able to make sure that I'm trying to spend more time with my family and making sure that my staff understands that that is a priority for them too. The work is important. What we're doing, trying to manage and plan, you know, for Charlotte's growth is very, very important. And we're all very passionate about being public servants, but you also need to make sure that you're serving your family, your close people that are close to you. So
we talked about the struggle. So let's talk about the good parts of it. Could you describe maybe just a little piece of something you're working on? Maybe it could be a very small project or something bigger that gives you real hope for the future of what you do. Charisse, you want to start there?
One of the things that was really inspiring to me in this work was our acquisition of the 32 properties in Hoskins. I remember the struggle days, and we have not, you know, arrived yet. We're not at the place where we've arrived, but I remember when we didn't have a budget to even have staff. I remember when we didn't own any land or have any units, and we were reliant on someone that aligned with us to subdivide their land and donate their backyard, or to purchase land and hold it for us, or someone to donate a house and us to go knocking on church doors and asking for donations to be able to, you know, move a house and renovate it. And so to go from that and, you know, trying to figure out how we're going to make this happen and really realize this work, to being able to buy 32 properties in one transaction, like for me was extremely inspirational. Like, we are doing something right. We are starting to get support. This is possible. And so that reinforced in me that even when things seem impossible, even when it may seem like too much to bear, even when it may seem like the barriers are insurmountable, that if you just remain persistent, if you just continue to stay true to the vision that you're carrying, that you can and will be able to accomplish it and more.
Allison?
So I'm really passionate about housing. I mean, that's the kind of thing that when I am awake at night, it's either worrying about it or trying to solve for it, or I've got an idea or any of those things. So I get really excited talking about housing. I know we could talk till probably the whole night talking about duplexes and triplexes. So trust me, I think and dream and breathe them all day. But I am really excited about the opportunities that the UDO has in terms of opening up opportunities for different housing options. And it's not just about the duplexes and triplexes. It's also about, there's some affordable housing incentives that we really just sat down like at the table with some affordable housing developers, like, what can I do to make your life easier? Tell me, I will write it in there. I think we've made some real headway on that. And then one of the other things that we're working on right now is having a set of pre-approved plans. And the one for ADUs will come out really soon. You know, already been designed. It's already gone through the building permit process. And so then you just apply it to your particular property. But then the idea is to expand that on to duplexes and quads and towns. And then what we can, what we're planning on doing is even scaling those so that we're providing a set of pre-approved plans that are already compatible with the existing neighborhoods and the lotting patterns where they are, so that we're making it easier for you to build housing that's more affordable and that's more compatible with the neighborhood in which you're putting it. So I'm really excited about that.
Great. Monique?
I heard a statistic that really made me sit and pause, and it was that we have over 3,000 grassroots nonprofit organizations in Charlotte that do not have space or can't afford space to be able to, you know, hold, if they just wanted to hold a workshop or you know, to be able to operate within a reasonable rate. So my husband and I were brainstorming, and so we said, well, how could we be a part of making a difference or an impact in that area for these small grassroots organizations? So we decided that come April, we're going to be opening and allowing nonprofit, grassroots nonprofits, to be able to hold their workshops at our location for a very reasonable rate, because right now you can rent our venue, and that's a much bigger price. But during the day, since typically we would have been closed anyway, we're going to open it up and allow these small organizations the opportunity to be in a nice environment and be able to have their workshops, because we have everything that's needed for them to do that at a reasonable rate.
I know this last question y'all get asked a lot, but we are in an audience of people who came to see y'all. And so I'm interpreting from that that they do care about these issues. They want to make a difference themselves. What's something that just regular folks can do to make a meaningful difference in y'all's areas of expertise? Allison, you want to start there?
Sure. What I'll start with is we adopted the comprehensive plan in 2021 and then the UDO in 2022. And what we're working on right now is community area plans. And so what that means is developing community guidance that's specific to those communities, not like rehashing the comp plan, but recognizing, again, not every single goal is your particular priority. And so we're going in and having this guidance for the entire city of Charlotte in the 14 different geographies. And it's really an opportunity for you to sit down, talk to staff, and talk about the things that are most important to the places that you care most about. Within that document will be maps for what it looks like in the future. There'll be programs that are important, what infrastructure is needed, what's missing in your area. And so I really encourage you to get involved in that. We were really active last fall, and we're kind of in a planning place right now in early spring, but we're going to gear back up in the summertime. And so I just ask that you get involved in that, and really staff is very excited and anxious to sit down and hear what you have to say and what you want for your community.
Monique?
What we're looking for at this point, and how you can really help, is our musicians, our local talent. I mean, we have so much of it. And we want to continue to be able to showcase these bands. Our genre at Society at 229 is jazz. So we do jazz and we do some old school R&B. but that's about it. What we are looking for now is businesses or corporations that would like to sponsor a night. That will help us to cover the cost of the band, But at the same time, so we can support our local artists, and at the same time, you can bring in your VIPs, your staff members, if you'd like, you know, whoever you'd like to schmooze at that time in your business. You have that evening, that's your evening, to be able to do and bring in who you'd like to enjoy the atmosphere, to network, and then have some good music for them. Of course, we have a full liquor license, so, you know, the sophisticated sips, as we call them, are available as well.
Charisse?
I would just say get involved. So it sometimes can seem very challenging to be able to make a contribution to something that seems so large. Like, how can little old me, you know, make a contribution to affordable housing or whatever else? And so for us, like, I think that I try to reinforce that every person has power. And so whether you become a member of the Land Trust, because we are a membership organization, where you're making a very nominal contribution and also supporting with decision making and such, or whether you're just raising our name in day-to-day conversations and keeping this work alive. As I mentioned earlier, I haven't done very well with marketing, and of course we have a focus on that, but our story has stayed alive because of media sources, because of individuals just at the dinner table talking about what's happening with the Land Trust. So there's power in that. You're in spaces and rooms that we won't enter, you know, into, and so you're able to represent us there. Even if you want to volunteer, we have several opportunities that are available for that, from canvassing and community cleanups to helping do, you know, basic tasks like our some landscaping or raking leaves or whatever else at some of our properties. And then all the way down to, of course, making a financial contribution or in-kind contribution. We all have skills and talents. So I think just getting involved, reaching out via our website and seeing how you can connect with us is one of the most beneficial ways to support our work.
One thing I thought about the most once our Southbound Live events were over was what didn't happen. Nobody yelled at each other. Nobody tried to shout somebody else down. Everybody, from the panelists to the audience members, listened to one another. And if they disagreed respectfully. It was such a counterpoint to the way we often hear these issues discussed. It's what happens when people have something meaningful to say instead of just wanting to hear the sound of their own voice. We hope to have more of these conversations in the future, and we hope you join us when we do. It doesn't have to be like you see on cable news all the time. Reasonable people can still work on big problems together. In fact, that's the only way they ever get solved. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR One app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound at our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.